I'm Greg Gutfeld, and this is the Fox News Rundown.
Thursday, September 20th, 2018. I'm Chris Foster. Ted Cruz is in a tough fight for a Senate seat in Texas that Democrats would love to take away.
If you have a good candidate in Beto O'Rourke, and you've got a candidate who really actually fires up both his base and the Democratic Party, the people who don't like him.
And Lisa Brady. One of the big lessons from Hurricane Florence, don't judge a storm's danger by its wind speed category.
Even though the category has been downgraded, it still doesn't mean that it's not a serious storm.
And I'm Jessica Tarlov. I've got the final word on the Fox News Rundown.
Look, if you're a wealthy liberal sitting in New York City or Massachusetts or San Francisco right now, and you could defeat one Republican in the country, it'd be me.
Texas Senator Ted Cruz in the polls is ahead in his reelection race, but it's a lot closer than some other Republicans and he might want or expect it to be.
It's about the future of this country, the big things that we want to do, going from the least insured state in the country to the one that leads on universal health care.
The Democrat in the race is Congressman Beto O'Rourke.
Beto O'Rourke is a third-term congressman from El Paso, Texas, who's the Democratic nominee against Ted Cruz.
Jonathan Tylov is chief political writer for the Austin American-Statesman newspaper.
El Paso is in a different time zone at the western end of the state, so he was very little known by most of Texas. When he began this race, he's becoming pretty well known, and he's sort of had a really good ride with sort of both state and national press, so he's becoming a known quantity.
You say he's actually the most gifted politician you've ever met.
Yeah, I met Obama on the brink of, you know, him becoming the Barack Obama we know, and I would put him up in that class, yeah.
Ted Cruz, he isn't just an incumbent. I mean, he's probably a top 10 senator in terms of name recognition. It's just his first term. I'd forgotten. It seems like he's just been around forever.
Yeah,
now,
exactly.
Now, Beto O'Rourke, you're saying, is a very special candidate. How much of that is a factor, and the fact that this race is so potentially close? Just some people just don't like Ted Cruz.
Right, and I think that's what's blown this race up and sort of made it, I think, among the most, if not the most watched Senate race in the country, is the passion on both sides. You have a good candidate in Beto O'Rourke, and you've got a candidate who really actually fires up both his base and the Democratic Party, the people who don't like him. And, you know, I think Cruz, this latest poll that showed him, you know, kind of increasing his lead to about 9 points from Quinnipiac, had Cruz with a slightly higher favorability rating among Texans than O'Rourke. So he's not quite as
unlikable as one might think
from reading about him. And he's, you know, he's a very effective politician. I mean, he is, he almost won the Republican nomination in his first term in the U.S. Senate after having never run for office before. So that's a pretty remarkable run. So these are two very gifted politicians.
And I know O'Rourke's been out there working hard and, you know, doing some nonstop campaigning while Cruz has been spending time away from the Senate as well. O'Rourke, though, as you mentioned, he's been getting a lot of help from national media, some pretty fawning profiles out there of him.
Yeah, and I think I was with Cruz last weekend, and I think he's, you know, he sort of mocks the kind of doting coverage that O'Rourke's been getting. I think it works for him as a foil, because I think what he's saying is that this is the favored candidate of the rest of America, or at least California and New York and Massachusetts, but that he's still the one in touch with Texas values. And he's still, I mean, he may have a point. I think he's still got huge advantages in this race. And as good a candidate as O'Rourke may be, even if everything breaks perfectly for him, it's likely he'll fall short.
Well, Senator Cruz has been kind of mocking Beto O'Rourke's Californication of Texas, maybe saying he's going to, you know, ban barbecue and get everybody eating tofu. I know he's joking, but do you think he's a little nervous?
I don't think he's actually that worried. I think he's pretty confident. But I think the reason he has confidence is because he plays every angle. And I think even the joke about, you know, banning barbecue had its intent, which is to just keep planting this seed in Texans' minds that Beto's not really one of them.
I mean, Texas is a red, maybe someday going on purple state with some really strong blue pockets. Is it going to come down to if everybody in Austin comes out and votes versus people in the country?
Yeah, I mean, O'Rourke's strategy, which is smart, but it may not be enough, is that he visited all 254 counties, and his appeal is he is going places that a Democratic candidate for anything really hasn't shown up in a decade or more. So he is attempting to, you know, drive up the margins in Austin and Dallas and Houston and San Antonio, and then reduce the, you know, the catastrophic losses in some of these rural areas and smaller cities. So he loses 70-30 instead of 80-20 or 90-10.
The GOP still has to expend some resources on a race that at one point would have considered more safe that maybe they don't want to do. You get a Libertarian in that race too, right?
Yeah, and you know the what tends to happen here is the Libertarians hold pretty well until the actual election. So, and they tend to then go Republican. So it kind of artificially depresses the Republican number in polls, and then when all is said and done, it turns out that instead of getting 4%, they get 1%.
Right. So it's one thing to say I'm going to vote for Neil Dykeman today. It's another thing to in November.
Yeah, to remember to do that, especially when you're, you know, the stakes will be driven home. There'll be an enormous amount spent. This will be, you know, really intensely fought, and I don't think the Libertarian candidate will be, you know, even an asterisk.
President Trump has said that he'll go down and campaign for Senator Cruz. Do they not hate each other still, or is it just strange bedfellows?
It's strange bedfellows, and you know, there's the risk. I mean, obviously, whenever they're paired, and when if he's coming here, there's always the stories about the awful things and the that Cruz said about Trump and the, you know, Trump calling him Lion Ted. But I think if you go to a Cruz rally at this point, I don't think there's really that much hard feelings against him anymore from the Trump people. And there's almost, there's very few of the Republican base who are disenchanted with the president. He remains solidly popular in Texas. He's probably more popular in Texas now than when he was elected.
So they have three debates, O'Rourke and Cruz. Are there issues that are actually going to drive voters to the polls, or is this just going to be the Democrats are going to vote for the Democrat and the Republicans are going to vote for the Republican, and it's all about turnout? Can they differentiate themselves on a stage?
Well, I think they can differentiate. It goes back to the base, but I think the Cruz strategy will be to indicate, particularly on issues like guns and the border, that O'Rourke is not in line with Texas values. And I think the O'Rourke strategy really is that he's trying to lower the temperature. He's the open, modest, you know, earnest guy who's not a Ted Cruz. He's not a provocative figure in the same way, and that he's really reaching out. So at the same time, Cruz is saying, if you elect O'Rourke and if you elected Democratic Congress, the next 2 years will be chaos and will be all about impeachment politics. So he's saying, if you want to maintain order and calm in Washington, you're better off voting for him.
Well, I guess we'll find out in a few weeks. Jonathan Tyloff with the Austin American Statesman. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
This is Jessica Tarlov with your Fox News commentary coming up.
President Trump gets a firsthand look at the mass devastation from Hurricane Florence.
To all those impacted by this terrible storm, our entire American family is with you and ready to help, and you will recover.
Visiting North Carolina to get a briefing on recovery efforts, hand out hot meals at a distribution center, and walk through damaged neighborhoods.
So you've never seen one like this?
Never. Never.
Before bringing a similar message of support to South Carolina.
Washington is with you. Trump is with you. We are all with you 100%, and we'll get through it.
The flooding left behind by Florence isn't over. Thousands still evacuated in North Carolina as rivers crest, the high water flowing downstream.
We've been driving around between both Carolinas throughout over a week now, and it's incredible to see how high the water has risen.
Fox Business Network's Christina Partsenevelis is now in Conway, South Carolina, where the Waccamaw River is expected to hit 21 feet.
So residents in this area are worried about supplies, worried about getting out, because they're expecting about 4 feet of water to seep in, not even from rain. We've had the flash floods in this area. Now they're expecting the river to flow in to create backwater. So that's an issue. And other towns that I was in both north and south, what you're seeing is just so much water that is not receding, and sewage water, contaminated water that are still in people's homes. So yes, the power is starting to slowly come back on, but all of these people have to rebuild once again.
You've also spent some time in rescue boats with volunteers who are going around trying to get people out who maybe decided to stay behind and ride out the storm.
People said, hey, I've lived here for 40 years. I've survived Hurricane Matthew, Floyd back in 1989. I've done them all. I can handle this one. The difference with this storm, and it's been downgraded, it was downgraded to a tropical storm, was that it hovered. It was a much slower moving storm. So that created more water. So was, when I was on rescue boats, it was, I had never experienced anything like it. The fact that we were on a highway, this was in Lumberton. So we were on a highway in Lumberton, on a boat, a rescue boat, just by volunteers, and we saw two completely submerged cars. We went into a gas station. I could, if I was tall enough, I could touch the ceiling of that gas station. And so, yes, there were some people that still needed rescuing because they felt they could ride it out. And then, unfortunately, they couldn't, so which is why we went with the rescue boats to go get them.
Forecasters did warn people, look, it's don't pay so much attention to the wind speed. There's going to be a big storm surge. There's going to be a lot of flooding. Did people just not, you know, did they overlook that, or did they say that they were just more paying attention to the category of storm that it was?
Yeah, I think that the problem with, especially when we have to report it and meteorologists have to report it, they report the category of the storm or the hurricane. And when you downgrade it, it doesn't seem as bad because it usually revolves around the wind speed. So the wind speed was lower, but it's the rain that was dropped that was so significant with Florence. And I think a lot of people were watching the news. They told me they were watching it, speaking to their neighbors, and they felt that, you know, it wouldn't be this bad because it's been downgraded and they survived previous storms in the past. I really think that was the reason you had so many people stay back, is because they've done it in the past and they felt confident. Unfortunately, that wasn't the case for a lot of people. You know, they've never had their house flooded, and now all of a sudden this time around it has been flooded.
Government forecasters say they're constantly trying to improve the way they communicate hazards to the public. Bill LaPenta is director of NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Prediction.
Well, I think we saw with Hurricane Florence, for example, you know, 4 or 5 days before landfall, the Weather Service was messaging the probability of life-threatening storm surge, life-threatening flooding. We talked about rip currents and surf, and we did also talk about the wind. And that message was really carried through not just the National Weather Service key messages, but picked up by the media, picked up by and used by the local authorities to communicate those hazards clearly as possible to the public. But I will say, based on Hurricane Harvey last year and the conversations that are occurring outside of the Weather Service with regard to Hurricane Florence and how people did respond to the communications, there may be an opportunity for the community to revisit that and take a look at other ways to better communicate or to improve the way we communicate the hazards.
If a change were going to be made, where would it come from? Where would that originate? Would it be from NOAA? Would it be, because the National Hurricane Center is under the NOAA umbrella, correct?
Correct. So the way changes like this would take place is the Weather Service and NOAA work with social scientists to try to constantly improve our communications. And so this particular matter, I think, will be discussed with social scientists. And I think there will be a debate, not just within NOAA, but I think within the social science and physical science community, to find a way to continually improve the messaging of the hazards associated with hurricanes.
There's so much information now. We have so much advance warning about a storm like this. Do you think that, is it a case of more information may not be a good thing because we're talking about it for days and days before it gets to land?
I think it is important to provide adequate lead time. And a key thing is when you have a long-lived system like Florence last week, you know, it was 4 days out, 3 days out, 2 days out. And even when there was a change in the wind intensity going from a 4 to a 3 and then eventually down to a 2, we were very clear in articulating that despite the fact the wind hazard has decreased in terms of the intensity, that the hazards associated with the flooding in terms of 20 to 30 inches isolated amounts over 40, that hazard did not change because the system was moving extremely slow. And we also continued to articulate that the fact that the storm surge threat was not changing, was not decreasing with time simply because the wind field had slowed down a little bit. And another aspect of the change in intensity is that while the maximum wind speed may have gone down in that hurricane, what happens is the actual aerial coverage of hurricane and tropical force winds increased. So that aspect of the hazard did go up. So it's a combination of these complicated features of each system that we work to communicate.
LaPenta says it's critical for people to listen to local officials and warnings. He also says there's no plan to change the way the Saffir-Simpson hurricane rating scale is used. But I asked Christina Partsinevelis if any Carolina residents have told her it would change their mindset if categories weren't used to describe hurricanes anymore.
Overall, I would say from the people I spoke to, they didn't focus too much on whether that would have changed their mind on categories, but I think they would hope that people would downplay a storm's significance. Even though the category has been downgraded, it still doesn't mean that it's not a serious storm. And I think we're too fixated on the terminology and the category level, and instead we should focus on previous devastation, how long it's taken infrastructures to rebuild, how old infrastructures are, and, of course, how much water is expected to fall.
Have you encountered a lot of regret, people who said that they wish they had evacuated?
I interviewed one woman for Fox News just a few days ago. She was in Myrtle Beach, inland. And what happened with her is that she was one of those people that told me she had survived these previous storms. She said she was watching the news, and then all of a sudden when the storm hit really badly, she started to have a leak in the middle of her ceiling. Then it started to drop. The fire alarm went off, and her home is, we drove out there to check it out, completely destroyed. And on live television, she just started crying, saying that she regretted staying and for everybody else to evacuate when they tell you to evacuate.
Christina Partsinevelis in Conway, South Carolina. Stay safe.
Thank you.
It's a brand new podcast based on the brand new book from Fox News political editor Chris Steigerwald, Every Man a King.
A short, colorful history of American populists. It's funny, informative, and useful, I think.
Find it now on Apple Podcasts.
It's time for your Fox News commentary.
Jessica Tarlov.
What's on your mind?
For the first time since President Trump nominated Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court, his confirmation is in doubt. I'm certainly not alone in having been surprised by these recent developments. I've been arguing for many weeks that Brett Kavanaugh would be confirmed, like most honest brokers out there. I wasn't sure how many red state Democrats would support him at the end of the day, but it wasn't out of the realm of possibility that he'd glide through with 54 or 55 votes. It'd be very difficult for Heidi Heitkamp, Joe Donnelly, or Joe Manchin to justify a vote for Neil Gorsuch, but not Kavanaugh. They're cut from the same conservative cloth, after all. Watching Senators Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski navigate the tricky waters of paying lip service to protecting Roe v. Wade while voting for a man apt to roll back protections for women was going to be interesting, and it certainly was. But they felt like a lock from the get-go. Then everything changed. Professor Christine Blasey Ford's account of an alleged assault by 17-year-old Brett Kavanaugh in the early 1980s was difficult to look away from. We know this because a majority of Republicans wanted to when the news broke, preferring to cocoon themselves in the shelter of Kavanaugh's days as a girls' basketball coach, golden boy at Yale Law School, and role model for many of his law students who were Hillary Clinton supporters. We read accounts from feminists that backed him, and Republicans even got a letter signed by 65 women saying they knew him in high school and he was a really good guy. It should be noted that not all of these women are standing by their letter. But now Ford has a letter with even more signatures that Kavanaugh is supporting her. And we'll get her chance to tell her story in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee when she decides the time is right. This wasn't the outcome she wanted. Ford wanted to remain anonymous and implored Senator Feinstein to keep her letter confidential. No such luck there, as is the case with most things in Washington. I can't imagine what it feels like to be Ford, not today or for the past 30 years, if the allegations are true. Her personal information has already been publicized and smear campaigns mounted. She has left her home and is receiving death threats. It is my hope, though, that she takes comfort in knowing that she did exactly what she should have done for our sake and that we arrived at the right outcome, a hearing. It is also my hope that Kavanaugh and GOP supporters learn a lesson in this about how to treat an alleged victim of sexual assault. Kavanaugh, or his PR team, showed a tremendous lack of judgment and decency in issuing a blanket denial without any gesture towards understanding and validation of Professor Ford's experience. There is a way to say that while you may not have any memory of this, Ford is not a liar who created a scandal for the sake of it, or, worse, for partisan reasons. Senator Orrin Hatch proved himself as out of touch as ever with his, "this woman, whoever she is mixed up" comment. No one who took the time to know who Professor Ford is or read her account would make a public statement calling her, quote, mixed up. We have yet to see what the hearings will yield, but I sincerely doubt that anyone in the room will see her as the one who is confused. The White House is much better off with Kavanaugh defending himself. It must have caused President Trump great anxiety having to address these claims without going to his default position. The woman is a liar. We now see him deflecting on an FBI investigation, but with enough pressure from the Democrats and the American public, I think it is possible that we will see that FBI investigation. Dr. Ford deserves to have her requests met. I continue to be heartened by the fact that we, as a society, have decided to believe women. That doesn't mean that an alleged victim's account is the be-all and end-all, but ignoring women is no longer an acceptable option. I look forward to hearing what Professor Ford and Judge Kavanaugh have to say, as well as living in a world wherein I never have to hear about that, quote, mixed up woman again. This is Jessica Tarlov.
You have been listening to the Fox News Rundown. Stay up to date by subscribing to Fox News Radio's hourly newscast at foxnewspodcasts.com. And for up-to-the-minute news, visit foxnews.com.